Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
9:38, 22 before 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Our discussion about Saudi Arabia, the attack that they think came from Iraq, or at least was sponsored by Iraq, continues. And we're asking, do you think that Saudi Arabia is our problem, or should we get involved in it? David Adesnik joins us, Director of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. Much too long since I've had a chance to visit New Orleans.
Well, we miss you. Come on back. Tell me your thoughts on the United States, its relationship with Saudi Arabia, and its responsibilities, I guess, our responsibilities as it relates to getting involved with the attack on Saudi Arabia from, they think it's Iraq.
Well, the U.S. has actually had a 75-year partnership with Saudi Arabia, going all the way back to when FDR met their king in World War II. And throughout the Cold War, we found ourselves on the same side against communism. Obviously, there was oil interests as well. They were the key producer in global markets. They remain an important producer, although the U.S. is actually now the world's number one. And yet there's also been some downsides, right? We've never fully been comfortable with their sort of Islamic model of rule, which is fairly authoritarian, very little room for dissent or protest about human rights. And at the moment, the big issue that's getting a lot of people agitated in Washington is that Saudi Arabia is fighting Iran in a proxy war in Yemen, a country just south of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, both sides have had pretty bad human rights records, but the fact that, you know, we provide or have provided fuel and other kinds of support to the Saudis means that some people on Capitol Hill feel we bear a measure of responsibility, and that's become extremely controversial.
Let me go back, if I may, for a second. I hate to interrupt you, David, but if I said Iraq before, I meant Iran. It's not Iraq.
Yes.
It is Iran. Secondly, when you talk about a proxy war, explain what that is, please.
Sure. So Yemen has been in a state of chaos for quite a while. It hasn't really had anything resembling a stable government that can rule the entire territory. So it has a government that's recognized internationally, that's meaning it's supported by the U.S., by other countries in the region, but it doesn't really exercise effective control. There's terrorists there, including al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. And there's also a group often called the Houthis, that have some religious and ideological things in common with Iran, and Iran has been providing them weapons with several years, and they actually control the capital, even though they're not the recognized government. And basically, these multiple sides have been going at each other in a pretty violent war for several years now.
So would it be accurate, if we're going to make an analogy, an oversimplification, that Iran and Saudi Arabia wanted to have a go at it, but they didn't want to do it like two guys wanting to fight, but they didn't want to do it in their own home to tear up their own home, so they decided to do it in Yemen and tear that up instead? Would that be accurate?
I think that's pretty accurate, with just a couple of tweaks to consider. In some ways, the Yemen one could be a prelude to that bigger fight. That you know, it's just south of Saudi Arabia, but separated by water from Iran. So in a way, Iran is trying to get a beachhead closer to Saudi Arabia. And one of the most provocative things they've done is they have put ballistic missiles, these large, fairly powerful missiles. They've helped the Houthis develop theirs and potentially given them technology that expands the range. So they've actually launched these proxies, have launched missiles effectively on Iran's behalf at Saudi targets, including their main international airport. I mean, I'm a D.C. guy, so I could just imagine, what if, you know, Canada was launching a large ballistic missile at Dulles Airport or Reagan Airport? It would be a pretty big outrage, and that's what's already happening. So even though it's a proxy war, it's not confined to Yemen. Saudis are taking direct hits.
So who would be the aggressor, Iran or Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's a little bit tangled up. So the fact that the international government is the side that the U.S. and Saudis are on gives us a greater measure of legitimacy. And the Iranians are basically supporting the rebels, who have a much weaker claim. But frankly, that country has been in chaos for so long that saying this side started it can be a little difficult.
You're talking about Iran has been in chaos?
Yemen has been in chaos. Gotcha. So to say that either any of the external parties is the one who definitively started it is a little hard, but we can certainly say Iran has been there exploiting the conflict, making it worse, giving weapons to one side, a side that is not internationally recognized.
And that was my next question. David Desnick, Director of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Those of you just tuning in, we're talking about Saudi Arabia and a response to Iran, if in fact that's where the attack came from. I know the president has already put some sanctions on Iran. Is that right?
He has just announced via Twitter that he's ordered his team to increase sanctions. Of course, over time, we have put some very tough sanctions in place as we pulled out of the nuclear deal that the previous administration put in place in 2015. There's room for tougher enforcement and for more sanctions, so we can up that. The very difficult question to answer right now is, given that Iran, and it seems that, you know, U.S. officials are confirming in an unnamed way to various media outlets that these attacks, we know where they originated from in northern Iran or in the parts of Iran, depending on where you count as north, near the Iraqi border, that the missiles and the drones came from there. We seem confident, but there's no public release of evidence yet. But on that basis, we're saying, yes, we want to do more. The question is, if we do more with sanctions, which where we have the advantage, we're a big, strong economy, Iran is anything but, that's smart. But if they they only hit us back in the wallet and they haven't hit us back with missiles or anything else, does that give us a license to attack them again in a violent way? So we're really trying to thread a difficult needle, all in the context of the president knowing he doesn't want another entanglement in the Middle East.
Let me take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the idea of sanctions, because to me, sanctions seem destined to fail, but I could be totally wrong. You're the expert. David Desnick, Director of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Back in a flash, if you have any questions or comments about this very complicated situation, which I have boiled down to, do you think the United States should get involved defending Saudi Arabia, I guess actively as opposed to maybe you can say passively with sanctions? I'd like to hear from you. Back in a flash here on WWL. 9:51, 9 before 10. Talking about the Middle East situation, the president moments ago said he's instructed his Secretary of the Treasury, I think it is, to put more sanctions on Iran. We're talking to David Desnick, Director of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Quickly, because I got a lot of questions coming in. David, if you can.
Sure.
The whole idea of sanctions, and I know this has been going on for a long time, but one thing I don't fundamentally get is that it seems like with sanctions, you hurt the guy on the street more than you do those in power because they retain their riches, their power, etc. With the idea that the people on the street are going to get angry enough where they overthrow the government. Is that the general idea, or am I stating that wrong?
So I think that was the idea at a certain point, and we've made a lot of efforts to get beyond that for sanctions to be smarter and more effective. I mean, I think a lot of people know we've had sanctions on Iran for almost 40 years, and they wonder what's that achieved. Because if it's been 40 years, things have only been getting worse between us and them. They may remember all the sanctions on Saddam Hussein before the Iraq War, and of course he lived in golden palaces. I got to visit one of them after he fell. Yes, I did. I spent 4 months working in Iraq with U.S. coalition forces as a civilian. Some very lovely gold-plated toilets.
Yep.
Really more the fixtures, right? You don't gold-plate the toilet itself. You got the sinks and the...
David, I have enough time getting mine and stop running, so... But anyway, to get back to the sanctions, philosophically, yeah. And I understand we've gone after trying to freeze some assets of the uppity-ups in Iran, but if you're hurting a guy on the street... In essence, you're weakening the very people that you expect to rise up and overthrow the dictator, are you not?
Well, you can be, but sometimes it's the frustration that leads them to do that. But I would really try to direct the attention to the fact that instead of just trying to ban trade with a country, what we're often now doing a lot of is identifying the illicit networks that do things like ship oil out of the country, procure nuclear parts, or engage in certain kinds of transactions. So, for example, some of my colleagues here were involved in a trial that went after actually a Turkish-Iranian guy, sort of from both countries, who was helping sort of use gold, large shipments of gold, as a means to get around sanctions. Or we do things like when they sell oil. This was a previous phase of it, but it's a good example. You know, the money went into sort of an escrow account, a holding account, where it could only be spent on certain commodities such as, you know, food and medicine, other things people would need, but not on the more illicit items that the, you know, the leadership may want to pad their own pockets. So it's really been about the evolution toward these more targeted sanctions.
We get some very good text here. Our listeners, very smart audience. Somebody texted this in. Tommy, if I guess I should have said David, because you're going to answer the question. If Saudi Arabia didn't have oil, would we still call them an ally? Or would they be the same as North Korea training terrorists instead of, say, developing some type of nuclear bomb, etc.?
Sure. I'd separate that into two parts. So, you know, most of the hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi citizens, and there was some really serious problems with the way that their regime was empowering the most radical people to spread that ideology. And in the years since 9/11, they've understood that there's a backlash there, that they've faced domestic threats from al-Qaeda and the Islamic State against the monarchy and the ruling family, and they have, you know, gradually come really more onto our side in the war on terror. This new crown prince especially has sort of said that those were the mistakes of the past. He's trying to move past them, trying to, you know, limit both the ideology and, of course, cracking down on the terrorists who are actually engaging in violent acts. So on the sort of the second half of that question, I think there's been a change in what Saudi Arabia is. And on the first half, if they didn't have oil, they'd still be on some strategic terrain in the region. Iran is trying to basically undermine every government in the region that is more Western inclined, and it is trying to strengthen or co-opt every government that'll work with it and try to attack the U.S., Israel, and other allies. So, just for that reason, I think we'd still be involved. Of course, it's hard to imagine what would the Middle East be like without oil.
You didn't come on for this, but let me see if I can pick your brain in the moments that we have left. Negotiating with the Taliban seems to me, on the surface of it, crazy, because you can't say you don't negotiate with terrorists when, in fact, that's exactly what you're doing. And how in the world do you know you can trust the people of the Taliban? And I'm throwing a lot of people into one group there. How can you trust these people? I don't understand the whole negotiating thing with them.
I'm with you 100% on that one. The way I'd put it is this administration said it would be smarter than the Obama administration on a whole lot of things, and now it's just implementing the Obama approach on a whole bunch of things. You know, if you wanted to make peace with the Taliban, you'd have to have a sense they're actually coming out of the cold. If they just stay terrorists and committed to terrorism, to their extremist ideology, there's no real negotiation. There's just surrender. If they really said, okay, we're breaking away from al-Qaeda, we reject suicide bombings that kill civilians by the scores, we're ready to deal with the government that's been elected in Afghanistan, then you could say, okay, there's a prospect. They're ready to change. What I see in the current negotiations is we're being suckered. They're not breaking with al-Qaeda. They're not stopping their terror attacks, and they're not doing anything to recognize the government. So I just think it's a fiasco, and it should be reversed.
And that's what I didn't understand, because the Taliban is not part of any government, are they? They're just an organization that seizes control of countries by terror?
Well, they think they're a government. Like the Islamic State, they say we're the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, is what they'd call themselves. And they actually govern the areas that are outside the actual government's control. So they're more dangerous in that way, rather than just being an organization that sends bombs around. And so they could continue to take control if we leave. I think the issue is, you know, after 18 years, no one's really comfortable with the continued U.S. commitment there. We want it to end. We don't want to pay for it. But just turning the country over to terrorists may be a pretty bad idea.
David, I appreciate your time. I hope you join us again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. David Adesnik, Director of
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.